Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for joining me today for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to talk about immigration through the hour today. In the first half, Bishop John Wester from the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City and chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration. In the second half, Eli Colley from the Utah Minutemen. This is still a hot topic. Legislature doesn't seem to have the appetite to revisit the laws that it passed last year. There was a challenge in the Senate, potential challenge to the guest worker bill, Bill 116, that was beat back. There is the House Bill 497, the enforcement provision, and that is in front of U.S. District Judge Clark Wadups. He says he may wait to rule on that until after the U.S. Supreme Court rules on Arizona's immigration law, Senate Bill 1070. There's another bill as well that was passed on immigration last time around. The issue, of course, is still with us, and interesting issues, very impactful issues for all of us. And we begin with Bishop Wester. Bishop John Wester heads the Diocese of Salt Lake City and, as I mentioned, is chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration. Bishop Wester, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be with you.
We appreciate you taking the time. We're going to talk about immigration, but I did want to get your comments on something that's been in the news, the Obama administration's shift, it seems, on a provision that would have mandated contraception coverage be provided by churches or church-run hospitals. There has been a shift there. Are you satisfied with that change?
Well, I'm hoping it works out, Tom. I don't know yet how it's going to play out. It certainly seems to me to be hopeful that we're in dialogue and trying to reach a resolution that all parties can be happy with. And so I take it as a promising sign. It just remains to be seen how that accommodation plays out in the HHS policies.
And from your point of view, the issue is freedom of these institutions, church-run hospitals and the like, to make their own rules?
That's right. One of the key issues for us would be the fact that under the HHS ruling, it was creating a two-tiered church, saying that, well, the church is free to, of course, have its rites and sacraments and rituals in the sanctuary, in the synagogue, the temple, the cathedral, whatever. But this, your church, what you call church work, doing social work, hospitals, education, that is not a church. And so we had a situation where the government's defining what is and what is not church, and that's a very dangerous slope in our opinion. And we feel that we're one church and that what we do, our charitable activities, are very much a part of who we are as church, and that should not be a bifurcation there.
But you're hopeful that this shift, it appears to be a shift from the Obama administration, will lead to rules that you can live with?
Right, that's right, that the shift would lead to us to be able to respect our consciences and yet at the same time the government be able to do what it needs to do. So I think that, you know, it seems to me anyway that the possibility of reaching a resolution is there, so we'll see what happens.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops recently held an immigration conference, as I understand it, here in Salt Lake City. You gave the keynote speech. We'll get into some specific issues, but just generally, what were the top points which came out of that conference from your point of view?
Well, we were very pleased with the conference last January. We had about 43 states represented. A lot of our Catholic conference state leaders were there and different people and concerned with immigration. And one of the key themes of it was, how do we deal with this reality of many states coming up now with immigration laws? Typically, we've been dealing with the federal government, and ultimately, that's whom we have to deal with. But what do we do now with all these states, our own, Arizona, Alabama, Oklahoma, et cetera, coming up with these laws? And how do we deal with this new reality? And how can we push the energy back toward Washington and things of that nature? So we were just kind of, that's pretty much what we were talking about in the nutshell.
In your address, you quote Pope John Paul II, And this might be considered a foundational plank here upon which I guess the Catholic bishops would base their views, quoting the fact that he is a citizen, talking about a human being, the fact that he is a citizen of a particular state does not deprive him of membership in the human family, nor of citizenship in the universal society, the common worldwide fellowship. I guess that would be the philosophical plank upon which you derive policy.
I think that's a very important plank. It's one of the many. And, of course, it's an important to see how we frame the issue, that we would look as a Catholic Church, we look at the issue not simply through the lens of the United States, but through the whole world. We're a universal church throughout the world. And we do believe, furthermore, that human beings have inalienable rights, God-given rights, and those rights cannot be taken away by any government or system. And so, at the same time, we also hold that a government has the right to enforce its policies, its laws, to, you know, certainly have safe and secure borders, and we also claim that right as well. So, but it's not an absolute right, and countries that have the ability also have a moral obligation to reach out to people. This is particularly true, obviously, in refugees and asylum seekers. It's a little more obvious in those cases, but it's also true for immigrants who are coming to our shores because of political persecution or poverty or what have you.
I want to follow up with that. It's a balancing act, I suppose. You said the nations have a right to make their laws, enforce their laws. On the other hand, people have their human rights. But on the other side, one of the big emphases is the rule of law. The nation has to have the right to control their borders, rule of law, and after all that's said and done, people who come into the country illegally are breaking the law.
That's right, and the church, our church, and most churches, obviously, would also agree with that. We are a nation of laws, and we respect the law, and that's our point. We respect the law so much that we want to see it do well, and so right now the law is inadequate to deal with the situation we're in, and so we need to see comprehensive immigration reform. The law needs to be reformed, needs to be changed to keep up with the times, and we've got now laws that are inadequate. We've got people who are, for example, temporary visas of about 5,000 or so. We need, you know, several hundred thousand of them so people can come and go freely and do the work that we need, that our employers need that kind of work, and then they would go home and then come back when the season begins again. But now the law is not able to keep up with all this, and in a way it's not fair because we have a sign that said help wanted, then we have another sign that says no trespassing. So we can't have it both ways. We can't, you know, benefit from the sweat equity of our immigrants and then just kick them out and wait for a new crop to come in. That's not fair. So it's not a question of disrespecting the law. It's a question of coming up with good laws. I like to say it's not so much that the immigrant is breaking the law, but the law is breaking the immigrant. And I think that it's important for us to look at the larger picture. And immigrants are not scufflaws. They're law-abiding, family-oriented, religious people in the main. And they're trying to help their family. They're trying to survive. And so I think we can have – it's good, you know, what's good for the immigrant is good for our country. We need to come up with a better system. And that's what we're advocating for.
What would that system look like from your point of view?
I think it would look like we would keep families together. We would prioritize. We'd have to have some kind of a system that would say, well, who comes in and who doesn't, obviously. So the country's going to have its need for, say, highly skilled workers, those kinds of things. So we understand that has to have a priority. But also we would like to see families staying together. We think the new system would allow families to stay together so that there's not this separation of families. Also, I think we'd have to deal with the very somewhat neuralgic issue of the fact that we have about 11.5 million undocumented persons in the country. What do we do with that large group of people? We would see a new system that would somehow allow an earned path for citizenship. Not amnesty, but rather that they'd have to pay a fine, get to the back of the line, learn English, whatever the case may be, but that there would be some kind of a path where these people would get some kind of status. Not all of them would get citizenship. Some of them would just get temporary worker cards, whatever, but they would be regularized and not living in the shadows any longer. We would also see a system that would give the immigration judges back a lot of the power that they've lost throughout a lot of this legislation in the past 7, 10, 12 years, that these judges would be able to, you know, they're the ones on the ground there that could see the situation and be able to have some of their authority put back. And also, I think, and this is more of a long-term solution, but I think that an immigration policy of the United States has to take into account working with these countries, the sending countries, why are people coming to us? Why are they so put upon to come here? We have to solve the root causes and really work with these countries and have the larger view. And this is a solution that's, you know, not going to be immediate, but I think we still have to tend to that.
Now, of course, people who want tougher immigration laws will say, you know, we already tried some of this. We had an amnesty a few years ago. We tried to put into place some of these measures, but the stream of immigrants will always keep coming as long as there is that economic magnet, and that we'll have to get tougher.
Well, that's what the long-term solution is about, to, you know, reduce that economic magnet. But even there, the 86 amnesty was helpful, but they didn't have enough follow-up, and they didn't do enough, you know, systemic changes in the system. So we pretty much had the same system, and we came back to the same relative position we were in, you know, before 86. So we do have to, and you're right, Tom, I think, you know, once we have a new system, it will mean that some people are going to want to get in, and they're not going to be able to. We can't take in everybody. That's just not plausible. But the tougher laws, the enforcement-only laws, putting more money in fences and tripling the border patrol and tripling the number of detention beds, we know has not accomplished it at all. It's got to be a combination of enforcement and generous, humane provisions together that's going to solve the issue.
In your view, what would the enforcement provision of an overall comprehensive law that you would advocate, what would that look like?
Well, I was talking to one of our legislators in Washington, and he said the same thing to me. He said, "Well, you should come out." I said, "Well, that's not my job. I'm not a legislator. I can speak to some of the principles. Our legislators have to hammer out what it would look like. But obviously, there would be border enforcement. There would be, I think, we'd have to have some kind of a biometric card that immigrants would have, especially the seasonal workers. We'd have to have a lot more of them, but they could come and go with that biometric card. I think we could certainly understand E-Verify as long as we work on the system. Right now, it's got too many. It's kind of like Swiss cheese, or too many false positives and all. But I think if we could get that system better, the E-Verify system better, that would be something that would be part of the enforcement, I would think. And then, you know, just typical everyday law enforcement kinds of policies that we're used to, I think, you know, we would have to have. But I think with the United States looking at the larger picture, I think we're capable of coming up with that system. But those would be some of the things I would think of at first.
If you just joined us, we're talking about immigration. In this half of the program, we're talking with Bishop John Wester, who heads the Diocese of Salt Lake City for the Catholic Church. He's chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration. You're welcome to join this conversation if you would like to do so at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. We'll have a different point of view in the next half hour. Eli Colley from the Utah Minutemen Project. Again, the number is 1-800-826-1495. One of the arguments or the concerns that people will bring up is that immigrants are taking too many resources. We pay our taxes, so health care and the like, that immigrants are taking up too many of these resources that should be provided to citizens.
Well, I do hear that a lot, but again, that's one of those things where it's frustrating, because I keep pointing people to State Department, websites and Social Security websites and things like that, and because all the data are clear that the immigrant is not doing that, but as a matter of fact, it's the opposite. They're actually helping our country. I remember talking to one of our state representatives, and he smiled. He said, I know what you're saying, and you're right. For example, and one given year, I think it was 2009, 2010, I forget now exactly, but the immigrants put in $5 billion into our Social Security system that they'll never receive the benefit from. So that helped our system, because it's money going in that won't have to go out to them. So, and that's true across the board. That in other words, they create, there's a certain synergy that immigrants help our economy. They help to our economy. You know, right now in Alabama, you know, crops are rotting in the field because of their draconian state laws on immigrants. So it's clear that, you know, the immigrant, in terms of our schools and hospitals, work, no matter how you look at it, they're not a drain on the system. They pay taxes like anybody else, for, you know, just buying things in the store. They pay into medical systems and all that, as I've said. So the data are clear on that. But it's one of those things that people, no matter what you say, they keep coming back with that statement.
Hmm. Then there's jobs. And it's kind of double-sided here. I keep hearing, I don't know how to quantify this. You see studies on each side that there are jobs that U.S. citizens won't do. So we need immigrants to do some of those jobs. On the other hand, some people will tell you that immigrants are taking jobs away from U.S. citizens.
Well, I think, again, that's probably anecdotally, I don't deny that there are some people who could say, well, my brother-in-law was going for a job and he didn't get it, an immigrant did. I mean, that's certainly going to happen on a case-by-case basis. But if you take a look at the entire landscape and look at all the data, I think you're going to see that immigrants actually are not taking jobs. They're actually making more jobs available. I was down at Manti at a turkey processing plant, and I didn't see long lines of our citizens trying to get into those jobs. They're very difficult jobs. They're not easy jobs, repetitive jobs, noisy, and it's not an easy job. And they're kind of entry-level jobs, but they keep those plants going and working in the fields and a lot of construction jobs, service-oriented jobs. These are jobs that open up other jobs for people. So if I want to have a hotel, I'm going to need certain people to do certain jobs that we're going to create other jobs for some of our citizens. So I think the reality is that we are a country of immigrants. I mean, we ourselves, we're all of us, eventually, except for the native born here, are immigrants. So, I mean, we've all assimilated and integrated people into the job market, and all the data show that it's not a drain on our jobs.
We are talking about immigration with Bishop John Wester of the Catholic Church. He heads up the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. He's chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration as well. You're welcome to join the conversation by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or by telephone 1-800-826-1495. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some experiences that your parishioners have had, some of your priests, and one incident you brought up in your speech at the immigration conference was an issue that we're very familiar with in Cache Valley. It was the 2006 raid, the Swift plant in Cache Valley. And you talked in your speech about the aftermath of that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was a very difficult for our people, for our parish there in Logan and St. Thomas. And there were about 200 of our parishioners who were deported, and it was very hard on their families. And I was talking to the local pastor up there, and he said, this was like 5 years after the fact, and he said, even after 5 years, the people are still, the ramifications of that reverberate through the community. People remember it. There's a sense of fear, a sense of not wanting to, a sense of having to live in the shadows, really. And the sad thing is that those kinds of raids don't really do anything, when you've got 11.5 million undocumented. 200 is just not even a drop in the bucket, so it's that's not where we need to. And I think the sad thing is that I do think we've, in fairness, I think the government knows that too. I don't see them doing that to this day with the same intensity. I think they realize they're trying to go after those who are more, they know to be felons, who are not your typical immigrant, those who the bad boys that shouldn't be there, and they're trying to go after them. And so, in fairness, I don't think that that's what happened in 06 is still happening the same way today. But nonetheless, it could happen. And I think the fear element remains, that people don't know, that you never know when it might happen again. So that's part of the issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's still reverberating, you say.
It is, yeah. I think people they have a feeling that they just don't know if they can set roots or what. They're waiting for a fix. They're waiting for the system to be fixed. And I think they live in hope. Our people live in hope that our government will come up with a fix, and I think we will. I have a lot of faith in our government. We have a wonderful country. It's the greatest country in the world, and I think that we're going to fix it, but in the interim, it's kind of hard for us as we wait for this. But so I think they live in hope, all right, but I think it's still very difficult for them. They don't know if they should stay or go back or what to do, but going back for many of them is a real tough sentence. It could be abject poverty. It could be persecution. Who knows?
I just wanted to follow up on that as well. In the light of Governor Romney's recent comments on the campaign trail, that if the laws get something, the fact that if the laws get tough enough, then people will self-deport. You were just addressing a little bit of that. For some people, they can't go back.
Well, that's right. You know, I disagree with that point of view because we've got tough laws, and we've been doing that enforcement only, and we know that it just doesn't work. Because what you're looking at is people who want to survive. The instinct to survive is very basic in a human being. You're looking at parents who want to provide for their children and feed their children and give them an opportunity and a life ahead of them, and these are sentiments that all of our parents and grandparents and great-great-grandparents have had coming to our shores. So I just can't believe that enforcement only is the solution. I don't think that we can have a situation without some enforcement. Obviously, we need that prudential, you know, balanced enforcement, of course. But to say that we just make the laws tougher, I just think that's flying in the face of reality and of what the data show. And it's also not recognizing, as I say, that human desire to find a better life and to really be able to prosper in life. And so people are going to do what they can to stay together as a family, to provide for their family. And remember, most of those people, a great majority of them, came here with the proper documentation and the visas lapsed. But they lapsed, but their roots have been settled here already. And where do you go? A lot of these children have been born here. They only speak English, or they may be bilingual, but they certainly only know this country. For them to go back, they don't belong. They were born here. They're United States citizens. So it's to tear up families in order to have the parents go back and the kids stay here. It's just not a workable solution, in my view.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about the Utah Compact. You know, the Catholic Church was very much involved with this. The first point in the compact is that immigration is best addressed at the federal level. I want to have you go over the other points, but first of all, the issue of the federal the venue being the federal government. I wonder if you can understand the frustration on especially the side of those who want tougher immigration laws, that the federal government looks like it's maybe never going to do anything about this, and certainly not this year during election year.
Right, and I can understand that. It's very frustrating. Every time we go to Washington and lobby for this, we keep getting told, well, this is an election year, wait for this, wait for that. And so in 07, they came very close. I think Senator Hatch told me they came within one vote of coming up with comprehensive immigration reform, but it just didn't pass, obviously. So it is frustrating on the states. I can understand that. But to me, I think a better use of our resources, our money and our energy, et cetera, our abilities would be to really put pressure on the federal government to do this and to do it right, and just not to, putting all these different state laws that are unworkable. We're going to have a hodgepodge, you know, a patchwork of different laws that are, you know, different from state to state, and it's just going to make things more chaotic. It make things worse. So I understand the frustration, but I just think we're spinning our wheels to come up with state laws when we need to. It's a federal issue, and only the federal government can grant citizenship, and they're the only ones that can ultimately. And even the state laws we came up with are going to have to pass muster, and as we see them now, tied up in federal courts, et cetera. So I do think that Utah, I would compliment Utah. I think that we really made a valiant and important effort to come up with humane laws and to try to avoid any draconian kinds of laws and to, you know, keep in mind that this is much more than a political issue. It's a human issue, and there's real human beings we're dealing with. And so I think Utah's led the way in many respects to try to find a balance and to do things in a humane way.
One of the principles in the Utah Compact talks about breakup of families, trying to keep families together as much as possible. Obviously, that is something very important, I would imagine, to the Catholic Church. Any law that would be made should take that into consideration?
That's right. I think that keeping families together, the family unit is very critical for our church, for our country. And I think that that's something we see as being very pivotal. And again, I do understand that the government will have reasons to want to prioritize certain kinds of immigrants that we need in our country. And that's understandable, and that's fine. But I think we also keep of equal importance is the importance of keeping families together. So, for example, right now it could take over 20 years for a person's case to be adjudicated. Well, you know, your three-year-old child will be 23 by the time you're back together again, and that's a whole lot of life that you've missed out on, a whole lot of family life you've missed out on. So that's just unconscionable in my view, and I don't see why we can't allow people to remain in place as their cases are being adjudicated, and that would make a lot more sense in my mind.
What do you think will happen with the the immigration law, the state law, the Arizona law and Utah law that's moving through the courts? What do you hope happens?
Well, what I hope happens is that they all get thrown out. I mean, from the standpoint that I don't mean to be glib about it, but I mean the enforcement provisions particularly are just going to, I think, put our police officers in a very precarious position. The 287G laws that, you know, make a lot of local law enforcement, you know, what do you call it, agents of the federal government, it puts a wedge between the community and police enforcement. A lot of the police that I speak to, you know, see this as being a very difficult thing. I think that it raises the specter of racial profiling. People who are here with status, with proper documentation, could all of a sudden become you know, very nervous and wary, and it just raises a lot of issues that are very troublesome for me. So I think that those laws were. Now we in Utah have some unique laws in the sense that we tried the, you know, the guest worker. I think it's 116, the guest worker bill, and those kinds of things, which were a different kind of law, you know. But again, I fear that that's not going to pass muster with the federal government, you know, that there, somehow the federal government's going to have to be involved in that, and Utah doesn't have the authority, as far as I know, to do that kind of thing. So ultimately, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I just think we're spinning our wheels to have state laws. We need to. It's a federal issue.
And we'll leave it there, out of time. We've been talking with Bishop John Wester, who heads the Diocese of Salt Lake City and is chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration. Bishop Wester, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom. It's a privilege. Thank you very much.
And coming up following a break, we will have a different perspective on immigration. Eli Colley from the Utah Minutemen Project will join us. Join us following the break.
Support for coverage of the Utah Legislature comes from USU's Department of Journalism and Communication, dedicated to free expression and mutual understanding in the information age, and covering breaking Cache Valley news at hardnewscafe.usu.edu.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
When I got up last Saturday morning, I didn't know I needed a toaster oven with a built-in television. That's one of the beauties of going to garage sales. They help you identify deep needs you never realized were there. Because we are poor, we always go to garage sales with a noble objective, intent on getting a bargain on something we would just be buying anyway. For example, we might go looking for an electric can opener, a weed eater, a $4 Bose stereo system, or a gallon of milk. Often, however, we buy items just because it's wise to do so. For example, I once purchased a small portable generator that we can use in case we ever lose power. The way it works, I learned, is if your power goes out, you plug it in overnight, charge it up, and the next day you can turn it on. Fully charged, it will make a loud generator noise for a good 20 minutes. It sounds a lot like a Harley without a muffler. This generator doesn't do much besides make the noise, but if a big storm hits, we'll be making a racket while our unprepared neighbors sit in silence. There are other things you buy just because you know you're staring at a once-in-a-lifetime deal that might never come your way again. For example, I once went to a sale where I discovered they were selling large, heavy, battleship desks with locking drawers for only $3. Of course, I purchased one and borrowed my father's pickup to get it home. The desk proved so heavy in my father's small Toyota pickup that as I drove home, I'm not sure the front wheels were actually touching the ground all the time, which can be problematic if you need to turn a corner. It was on that long and frightening trip home that I realized I had no room for the desk in my house. It slowly dawned on me that I would have to put it at the head of our driveway outside, which I think would be a cool spot for a desk, until it rained for the first time. However, those were just details. The important thing was that I had nabbed a great deal on a monstrous desk and saved wear and tear on my dad's front tires all at the same time. I often buy cassette tapes at garage sales. For example, in a recent batch, I discovered a tape called Successful Elk Calling. The tape promises to help with grunting and barks. Who hasn't needed a bit of help with their grunts and barks at some point in their life? Occasionally, when rich people open their neighborhoods for yard sales, you come across people you can tell have never been to a yard sale before. For starters, They don't know there's a state law that requires every garage sale to be offering up at least one piece of exercise equipment. Their items are carefully folded, displayed, and tagged. They might be offering a sweater that was originally $60 for just $50. They always have this confused and offended look on their face as people walk away laughing. I never hold my own garage sales because I fear drive-by rejection. That's when somebody pulls up to your house, looks over your splendid display of treasures, and then just drives away without even getting out of their car. It's humiliating. I wonder if they would do the same if they were looking at a Klingon garage sale. I'll bet not. If you've watched Star Trek, you know that Klingons have a strong sense of family honor. You turn your nose up at a Klingon garage sale, and one of them will probably track you down and kill you for the insult. Garage sales are a frontier explored only by those with vision and tenacity. If that's not you, you should stop by some Saturday. We'll eat toast, watch TV, bark and grunt a bit, and then go off in search of a weed eater. You don't know what you're missing. This is Steve Eaton.
Support for coverage of the Utah Legislature comes from the USU Charter Credit Union, serving members with online bill payer and web teller services for around-the-clock account access. Information is at usuccu.org.
Thanks for staying with us through the break. We are spending the hour talking about immigration. It's been much in the news, of course, nationally and in Utah news. The latest news is that House Bill 497, one of Utah's immigration laws, was passed last year. It's in the courts now. Federal Court U.S. District Judge Clark Waddups said at the conclusion of a hearing, which happened last week, that he might wait until the Arizona law, SB 1070, is heard at the U.S. Supreme Court in April before he rules on the Utah law. There were two other Utah laws that were passed last year. We're checking in on the immigration debate this half hour with Eli Colley, who's with the Utah Minutemen Project. Eli Colley, welcome back to Access Utah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir.
We appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I wonder, first of all, what your hope is with these laws. Arizona's 1070, Utah's 497. I'm guessing you hope they're upheld. What do you think will happen?
Well, Mr. Waddups happens to be the relative of the head of the Senate, the individual now who is Mr. Michael Waddups, who is so heavily in support of HB 116. So I don't expect that HB 497 has much of a chance before the judge. And there has been a move across the board on the part of federal judges at the lower levels to rule against the assistance that states might provide the federal government in dealing with the invasion. So I don't expect HB 497 to go anywhere.
Is it a fair characterization that you believe, as does Bishop Wester, this is a federal issue, but that since the federal government is not acting, that the states must?
I agree generally, but specifically Article 6 tasks all judges and executive officials in all the states to support laws passed under the Constitution. And what has happened in this state and in many other states is that there has been this false dichotomy between federal enforcement and state enforcement of federal law that doesn't exist in any other area of the law. That is particularly propagated by Attorney General Mark Shurtleff, who absolutely refuses to acknowledge his responsibility under the Constitution to help enforce federal immigration law. Now, the Congress of the United States sets the terms and conditions under which that must take place, and it has with, for example, 287G, and we are going through litigation, state by state, case by case, where states upset with the inability of the government, federal government, to enforce a law, have acted on their own in support across the board of federal law, and this is the case of 497.
Use the word invasion, which would connote urgency, a big problem. I wonder if you could expand on that. What do you see this the scope of the problem?
Well, when you have 40 million people who are in your country illegally and tens of millions of them have been smuggled into your country by the Mexican mafia cartels, I think that that pretty much qualifies as an invasion under anybody's definition. And the fact that you have so much compassion mongering from the religious institutions in our state doesn't take away from the fact that we are under invasion from these people. Who are basically being exploited by the businesses and being pandered to by the religious institutions in order to get their butts in the pews. And so while you may not have tens of millions of people coming across with weapons, what they are doing is coming into our communities and forming enclaves in which the rule of law does not have the validity that it does in the rest of our society. And they, many of these communities are closely connected to and intimidated by the Mexican drug cartels that operate with impunity in those communities. And so we are under invasion, and we need to deal with it expeditiously.
Aren't most of these people good people just seeking a better economic future, law-abiding, well, except for the law that they broke to come to the country?
Well, that's the myth that has been propagated by Bishop Wester and the LDS Church and other compassion-mongering organizations. But the bottom line is that prior to coming into our country, they pay off the coyotes. Well, who controls the coyotes? The Mexican mafia. So what they're doing is they are funding the Mexican mafia prior to even crossing our border. Then then they come across our border and they break the law. What's the first thing they do? Well, they get illegal documents to work. And they again pay off organized crime, again controlled by the internationally organized mafia. And so when you ask me, are these people good people, would you do that? Would you knowingly pay off the organized crime cartels? I wouldn't. And I would hope that no one else would think that's a moral or ethical act. So I seriously question Mr. Wester's judgment, for one, and the judgment of many other religious leaders who've come out on the opposite side of this issue to propagate this myth that they're just good people and honest people and they only want good for their families. And that may be true, but if that's true, then why don't they do it the right way? Mm. Now, and that's prior to... that paying off organized crime comes prior to them stealing our jobs. And then once they steal our jobs, they enter into this cycle where they commit identity theft and document fraud, and then they move into tax fraud and welfare fraud and credit fraud, Medicare fraud. They get into our medical systems, and they use false Social Security numbers, and their information is put into our medical systems. And it's just one thing after another. So the vast majority of these people who are coming across the border, I look at as criminals. And the people who overstay their visas are in the same situation. They have to get illegal documents. And so they go to these document mills run by the organized crime cartels. And so, once again, they are paying off organized crime. And people may not think that's much of a threat, and it doesn't assault their sense of ethics or morality, but it certainly does mine. And so when people try to propagate this myth that these are just honest, hard-working people, I don't believe it for a second.
Hmm. Now, in your view, then, are these the majority of these people good people who just got sucked into this system, or are they essentially, by the end of this, bad people?
Well, the listeners can answer the question themselves. Would you pay off organized crime? Would you fund the very cartels that are now slaughtering tens of thousands of people across the border into Mexico so that you could come and enrich yourself off American society? Would you do that? Is that an ethical act? Is that a moral act? It may not be illegal in Mexico to pay off organized crime, but it certainly is unethical and it certainly is immoral by any standard. So people can answer that question for themselves.
If you just joined us, we're talking about immigration. And the last half hour, we had Bishop John Wester from the Catholic Church. This half hour, we're talking with Eli Colley from the Utah Minutemen Project. You're welcome to join this conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can get an email through to us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. Here's an email that was addressed to Bishop Wester. This is from Michelle, but the bishop is gone. We have Mr. Colley on with us, and I wonder if I could phrase this and send this to Mr. Colley. Michelle says, talks about Catholic social teachings like the dignity of the human person, rights and responsibility, dignity of work, rights of workers. And that is one of the arguments on the other side, Mr. Colley, that these, after all, are human beings, and some of these laws are splitting up families, for example, which can't make anyone happy. I guess you would say this is necessary.
Well, I disagree with the premise. All these people who are here in our country illegally are not irrevocably put on the path to breaking up their family. They can take their families and leave and go back to their home countries. Just like they broke up their families, many of them, to come across into our country illegally. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that so many of the families are broken up when these people invade our country, but they sure want to whine and moan about the enforcement of the law that requires the illegal alien parents to go back to their home country. So I disagree with that premise altogether. And, you know, as far as the dignity of the person, under the Constitution of the United States, you enter a social compact and you give up your freedom so that you can be protected in your body and in your activities under the rule of law. And so these people who invade our country are outside the social compact. And I, for one, look very unfavorably on those, largely in the business community, who believe that it's fine to override the rule of law on the one hand in order to get cheap labor, and yet on the other hand they want to take every little jot and tittle of the law that supports them. I think that's hypocrisy.
So you believe that some of the business community are complicit in this?
I believe that a large portion of the business community is complicit. Mm-hmm. And it starts with the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, who's fought tooth and nail to get HB 116 passed and to prevent it from being derailed. It was subsequent legislation. So, yes, they are complicit, and not only that, but they are indirectly pouring money into the organized crime cartels that are killing people across the border in Mexico. So their morality and their ethics, considering the dynamics that are involved in their profit-making, are open to question at the very least on the basis of their affiliation with organized crime.
I wonder, in an ideal world, if you could get the laws that you would like to see passed, what would the ideal mix of immigration laws look like?
Well, generally, I'm pro-enforcement, but we're in a situation now where the people who have invited illegal aliens into our country for economic reasons largely control the public debate. And so nobody came to me and millions upon millions upon millions of ordinary citizens and said, is it okay if these illegal aliens come in? Because we already set what our opinion was and our policy was through our elected representatives through the Congress of the United States. And so yet these people are in here, not at my behest, but at the behest of the people who are getting cheap labor from them. So I would be in favor, for example, Chris Herod is running an HB 300 bill up there that would allow some of these people who've come into our country who haven't committed crimes, who haven't come across the border and paid off organized crimes, who haven't sucked off the welfare state, to be able to regularize their status and be either self-deport after a time period to get their affairs in order or be able to go get a visa and regularize their status in the United States. So I'm in favor of that for those people who haven't been committing these crimes. And so in addition to enforcement, you do have this alternative that at present is in the legislature right now. So we're in a situation where we cannot deal with, for example, the students who've been here all their lives, who are illegal, because people are fed up with the invasion, and they're fed up with the social and the tax costs and all that, and so they're unwilling to grant an inch to these students who they ordinarily would say, oh, fine, let's regularize their status. And that's the situation that we're in now. I know that's a fact because I brought this subject up in our meeting about a year ago, and we had tremendous support for that. But people understood the dynamic of so much happening and so much going against the interests of the people has forced us into this corner, and that's where we are currently.
We are talking with Eli Colley from the Utah Minutemen Project. You're welcome to email us at upraccess@gmail.com or call us at 1-800-826-1495. We have about 7 minutes left with Mr. Colley. We're talking about immigration, obviously, and the bills from last year are moving forward in the courts or toward implementation. And Arizona's laws moving forward in the courts as well. This topic much with us and will be with us into the future as well. The number is 1-800-826-1495. I'm curious about border security. I wonder how far you would go. One suggestion on the campaign trail, I believe it was Herman Cain. I think he brought it up. I don't know if he stuck with this, but it has been brought up. A lethal fence. Would you go that far?
Excuse me. No, sir. I think that's a very untimely and very inhumane approach to take, and we wouldn't expect the Mexicans to put up a barbed wire fence with electricity running through it on their side either. We need to put the military on the border, for one thing, and we also need to spend the money that wasn't spent but allocated to make sure that the fence is as high as it can be in those areas where it's deemed appropriate, and then continue to make sure that the organized crime cartels can't reap lucrative profits off their human smuggling. That's the most important mission, as far as I'm concerned, at the border.
Now, anything you put up, I guess you could put up an impenetrable fence, but that would be prohibitively expensive. But anything you put up, isn't that going to be circumvented by smugglers and the like? Isn't the real root source of the problem this economic magnet?
Well, two things. Number one, if you build a fence, and it's a pretty stout fence, and you patrol the fence, that'll take care of the vast majority of people. And yes, you're going to have a small percentage circumvent the fence. But it's very small. And you'd be able to deal with the numbers coming over in other ways. And it's interesting you ask this question, because the real magnets, as you pointed out, are jobs. They are state and federal benefits. And then there are the churches who want these people to put their derrieres in our pews, and they provide benefits like rent subsidies and food and you know, volunteer jobs and whatnot to these people. And those need to be completely cut off, which is what our initiative petition, the Cats of Crusader Initiative petition, is all about. We intend to use E-Verify and other tools to make sure that these people cannot get jobs and thus take away one of the greatest magnet to these aliens coming into our country.
Michelle, who I referenced earlier, has another email, this one directed, I believe, to you. Mr. Colley, I'll have you respond to this.
Sure.
I believe there's a lack of understanding when it comes to the poor. It is not reasonable to assume the poor, who usually do not have a reasonable education level, including lacking the ability to read and write, would have any clue where the money they pay are going to. I understand there's an issue with illegal immigrants. However, you're leaving out the basic human respect when you view them as objects and use a lack of understanding of where they're coming from.
Yeah, I would view that from the opposite point of view. They don't care about me, and they view me as an object of enrichment for them and their families personally through my taxes. And they don't have any respect for me or our laws or our institutions or our history or our Constitution when they invade. And so I think it's a canard for people to foist on compassionate-minded people that we need to be respectful of their humanity, whereas they don't have any obligation to us to respect our laws or to respect what the expressed representative will of the people has been.
We do have a couple of callers, and we'll try to fit these in. We just have about 4 minutes, so we'll ask our callers to be brief, and Mr. Colley to be brief in his response. We do want to fit these in. Maria in Logan is first up. Thanks for calling, Maria.
Yes, you're welcome. I just wanted to say that I disagree very strongly with everything that this gentleman has been saying. Clearly, he really does not understand the situation. He does not know the people, and he does not know what brings them here, and he is completely ignorant of all of their many, many very important contributions to this society. I want to emphasize again, and I cannot emphasize this enough, they are human beings. They are human beings every bit as much as I am, as that gentleman is, as anybody that you know, that you call your friend, your family, and that you love. They are flesh and blood human beings. To connect them to organized crime and to drug cartels is a complete mistake. Nothing could be more wrong. I don't know the details of how they cross the border, and I don't know that they know where their money is going.
Okay.
I know that they cross the border out of deep need to be able to survive and to provide a better life for their children. They seek to do no wrong. They only did what every other American did in coming to this country. That
okay, Maria, we'll have to leave it there. I appreciate that comment. We want to fit in a response from Mr. Colley and then get in Bob's call as well. So I'll ask you to be brief, Mr. Colley.
Sure. The type of comment you heard is typical of those people who have no grasp of the situation as it is. I would disagree on every single one of her points, except the fact that these people are human. And my information comes from the United Nations divisions on organized crime. And so, I don't know quite how to respond, not having time enough, but she's completely wrong in every single one of the points, except for the fact that these people are human.
Well, I'd love to have a bigger discussion on those
so
points and give Maria a longer time, but we're running out of time. I do want to fit in Bob. Bob in Moab, thanks for calling, Bob.
I appreciate you taking my call. I'd like to point out that I believe that the federal government's trillion-dollar debt that's running every year, and now $1.3 trillion this year, is what's funding a lot of this. It's what's keeping Americans that are we don't have manufacturing jobs anymore. They're just commodity-type jobs that Americans don't have to do because they have this enormous deficit spending that's giving them unemployment benefits to be doing these jobs that the Latinos are doing. And I think we're heading on the same path that Greece is in, and it's very likely that many of these illegal immigrants are going to be heading right back down to Mexico as soon as the United States becomes Greece-like.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. And just have about 30 seconds for a response, Mr. Colley.
Sure, that's a pertinent comment. There's no doubt that the massive amounts of unemployment benefits to citizens have allowed them not to go out and compete in the marketplace for these jobs. And so thus you do have illegal aliens being protected by federal policy. And as far as the deficit goes, yeah, I believe Bob is correct. And we're giving billions of dollars to illegal aliens in benefits as well.
Well, much more to say on the subject. We'll have another program coming up on immigration. Eli Colley from the Utah Minutemen Project, thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you. And you have a good day, sir.
Okay, you too. And if you'd like to email us some comments to prepare for the next show on immigration, we'd love to have those. Maria, Bob, Michelle, we'd love to have some of your comments in email form, perhaps. And we'll treat some of these points that you made a little more fully on a subsequent immigration program. In the meantime, we appreciate Mr. Colley and Bishop Wester for being our guests on Access Utah, and we appreciate you listening. Tomorrow, our subject is air quality. And that's coming up tomorrow on Access Utah. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan. KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
For more up-to-the-minute news across the state, find Utah Public Radio on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our website at upr.org.